But what you find is that the support, the wraparound services, the advising capability is really the bridge at an institution. And Purdue did this great study that said that 70% of the students that ranked their school high did so for reasons beyond the classroom experience, right? And the people that they remember, the people that they would claim got them through to the degree, were not in the classroom. And it might have been that same faculty member, but it was the faculty in an advising or another capacity.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany Snyder, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Tiffany. Glad to be here.
We are bringing back one of our favorite guests, Nathan Green of Acadia. Welcome back, Nathan.
Good morning.
I don't know how many different partners you have you're in collaboration with at Acadia, but I imagine there are a plentiful number of success stories. And then maybe some others that have some room for improvement in terms of the partnership relationship. So what does that look like to be in a successful partnership with an institution?
Yeah, that's my favorite question.
Oh, good.
Are our schools successful no matter what they accomplish? So I have a mentality in that I'm not alone, but I might be the minority at my company where I take this approach of no school left behind. And a school that has done zero enrollments after 18 months or 2 years is still worth investing in. And I'll use Dillard as an example. We launched Dillard and they did no enrollments. We had no engagement, no activity. Two of my colleagues went to New Orleans and never visited. And then I visited. And I'm not in account management, by the way. My role was sales. I ran the sales team. And when we started, I was sales, marketing, and account management. And then we grew and created more verticals. But Dillard was already sold. They should have had an account manager. They did, but they were, I don't want to say ignored, but no one wanted to take the time to invest in and get to campus. In 6 months, they did more enrollments than any other institution that year. And now 2 years later, they've done more enrollments than any institution ever, even after being around for 4 years.
Wow.
And all it did was me sitting down with the registrar and asking, frankly, where are you stuck? And he said, I just don't know where to get started. Now, he had been onboarded. They had had a number of meetings, but there was that urgent versus important paradox. And when you're a registrar, important always trumps urgent. That's literally the definition of a registrar, right? You get that student the course to graduate. You've got to review a transfer course to graduate. You've got to do the degree audit. And so urgent is always precedent in the registrar's office. And you've got the important with the CAO and the other cabinet level. So ultimately, what we learn is that it takes spending time with each account, understanding their goals, more importantly, what's blocking them from accomplishing their goals. And then because this last year, we've seen a turnover in our network of schools of up to 15% of the users or leaders on our campus, 15% or more have turned over, meaning we send an email and it bounces. Person we were working with is now gone.
Oh, wow.
And that's the turnover that we're seeing across higher ed, not just with our network. We have to redo those early onboarding and face-to-face or Zoom-to-Zoom now sessions to get the new leader, the new user up to speed. And that's a challenge that all of vendors in higher ed are facing. That's a challenge that higher ed is facing across the board in terms of sustainability. But no one's hitting their numbers in higher ed from an enrollment perspective. I mean, there are some that do online that are doing well, but the traditional residential campus are missing their numbers by many, many percents. And so there's a lot of turnover. There's also a lot of unhappiness at the leadership level on institutions. And people are saying, I don't want to be in higher ed anymore after an entire career. And so, you know, in the last year, we've hired former provosts that have taken pay cuts to just get out of higher ed as an industry, but still support it as a vendor. Our last three hires have all come from the academy. we're senior people, but they are done with higher ed. So this is presenting some real problems both for the industry and for vendors. And so my philosophy is always there's no unsuccessful institution. There are just underperforming. And we need to understand why does an institution that signed an agreement, schools don't sign agreements lightly. They don't pay annual fees because they have no interest in using the software or supporting students. So what's keeping them from being successful? To that end, Tiffany, we just rolled out a new account management function. Each of our schools are going to get account managers and they're going to do what I did at Dillard. And they're going to sit down with the school, even if it's not in person, and they're going to say, where are you stuck? And we're going to spend countless hours working those schools to be successful versus just sign them and hope that they know how to click the button.
That's awesome.
To your other question, we have 400 plus institutions on the platform.
Wow.
And I would say, to answer your question another way, probably 20 to 30% are where we'd like them to be. Another 30 or 40% are, without much guidance, going to get to where we want them to be because they're doing the right things. They're showing the right behavior. They're connecting the dots on where course sharing can solve a structural or student or scheduling problem. And then we have another 30% that need a restart because of leadership changes or just a lack of awareness about how this can help or where it can help. And that's a problem that all vendors see in higher ed. And because we make most of our money on the enrollment, if the school's not using us, then we're losing money on that account. And that's where another percent of our company says those schools are not successful, right?
I'll just get your best account managers, right?
We literally are hiring the best account managers to dedicate to our team. That's absolutely correct.
So with all those partners, roughly how many courses does that represent?
Yeah. So Brad, let me define what it means to be a partner, because that will help in answering the question. So we have what we call home institutions and teaching institutions, and then some that are both. So a home institution, they might have online, but their focus is on giving their students a second schedule, access to online courses. Most of our schools in the network are home institutions. So of our 400, let's say 250 for easy math, are home only. There are only consuming courses for their students. They're not offering. Then we have probably 15 to 20 that are teaching only, like Indiana Wesleyan, Kaiser, and Baker College. They are only offering courses. They do enough online that if they need it online, they just grow the faculty and program organically. And then the balance, the 120 plus that I'm the next group, is home and teaching. And depending upon the orientation of the school, even honestly, depending upon who we talk to that week, they might be more teaching or home oriented. And what we see are schools that start as one and become the other, because it is the lift to try and do both at the same time. Our hope is that every school is both over the next 5 years, that home institutions grow enough online to be able to start offering empty seats. And certainly we know that teaching institutions, even a school the size of Indiana Wesleyan, has the occasional need to lean on another college whenever there's a sabbatical or a pandemic or any other unexpected demand that might come up.
Fascinating.
So what project are you working on that excites you the most?
So that was a tough one to answer because I've got a lot of exciting projects.
That's good.
Yeah.
If you can't tell, I'm easily excitable. So that's actually probably one of the bigger challenges. But in January, we brought on not only the first account management staff, but a new president for the company. And that has allowed me to develop what I like to call what's next for the network. So in the last year and a half, we've become the largest network in higher education just based on number of dollars flowing through our system. I think we created that category and then we assigned ourselves the leader in the space.
That's the way to do it.
That's good.
We are the top course sharing consortium in the world and the only. So, you know, that helps. So the network allowed us to go after what we call enterprise partners. So now we have institutional partners, the schools, and now we have enterprise partners. And it started with Coursera. So Coursera approached us and said, we've seen what you've done with that consortial model. Do you think you could get our certs and our courses credit bearing? And so we have launched something called Coursera for Credit.
That is huge. That is huge.
It is big. It is big. And so they IPO'd during that time frame. And so now we have a $6.5 billion partner, and we're the only reseller of Coursera certs worldwide. We have an exclusive relationship. And it's not to sell the content. I mean, they do a good job of that. It's to attach credit to the certs and even the courses. And so that plus some other enterprise partners allowed us to create this new division, which we term business development internally and what's next for the network externally. And so I mentioned earlier that we're bringing alternative revenue to our clients. It's all coming from these enterprise partners. So the three that I'm most excited about, again, Coursera being what catalyzed this new department, which I run, is InStride, which is the old Arizona State Starbucks business that they spun out 2 years ago when Uber came to them and said, hey, I like this idea. Where do I sign up? We are blessed to have schools like Indiana Wesleyan that we brought to InStride to help employee education and tuition reimbursement. So that's corporate or workforce. And that's a new vertical for us with InStride. We also got into dual enrollment, and our partner is K-12, which is now Stride, but the largest publicly traded company in the K-12 space. So we've got the top workforce partner. We've got the top dual credit or high school partner. It's been a goal of mine to get international. We do work with Oxford in the UK. We work with schools in Mexico and Canada. We just signed a school in Morocco. And so we are international, but again, it was still institution to institution. And then recently we partnered with a company called Link Education. They run a website called The World Grad, where you start year one in India. And this was before the pandemic, where now you're stuck in India. But the model was you start year one in India and then you matriculate to Australia, New Zealand, and some of the lower cost, but still reputable institutions outside of America. And then last year they said, all right, we want to get into the US. And because of the pandemic, they leaned on us. So we are year one. I mean, they've tapped a few of our partners to provide that year one remote experience. And then the students get their transcripts and they will matriculate to the US.
Wow.
And so what we've created are these intersections between various partners to the higher education market that effectively unbundles the degree in different ways. And that's what we think is the future. And that consortial model, which we didn't invent, but we're the first to automate, keeps paying dividends to these different concepts of what we call an enrollment or a student that, you know, I was just on with one of our partners yesterday and I said, hey, let's take your 4-year degree and let's marry it up with all of our 2-year schools. And let's create a pipeline that allows any 2-year student to know that they're going to get a 4-year degree in one click, right? Or get admitted into a 4-year degree in one click. So again, it's this concept of the consortial arrangement that is a deeper connection between the colleges than an articulation agreement. And the fact that we're wired up at all of our schools for payments and to move data that allows us to do something that I would say no one else in higher ed has ever accomplished. That's a good accomplishment in 4 years, but just the starting point of what I think will be a much bigger role that we're going to play in higher ed, not just nationally, but internationally, to unbundle and break down and collapse what we consider to be a degree with 2-year, 4-year, public, private, even for profit, and then ultimately what we consider a credential versus a degree. And that's just 7 months, literally. We started this in January.
So let me propose a scenario to you. Let's say that I'm a really savvy student or I have a good coach and I view Acadium as kind of a buffet. So what I'm going to do is pick and choose the best courses, the best instructors based upon the data I can get. I ultimately know where I want to graduate from and I know what their minimum requirement is in terms of the number of hours I have to complete there. I do everything as an on-ramp to that, enroll at that university, do the last 30 hours there, and get my degree.
Brad, what you just shared is what I want to do with my kids and what I think most parents would want to do if they had the mechanism to drag and drop a degree. What I believe is that the best path to a bachelor's degree is 2 years at a community college and then 2 years at the four-year school of your choice, right? The local community college to the four-year school of your choice. And that is proven to be the most economical path. So now all we're doing is we're removing the labels of a two-year, four-year environment. We're saying you can pick and choose where to start, when to start, but as long as you've got college algebra from somewhere, you've got college algebra in your degree.
Yep.
And part of what we're disrupting, Brad, is this notion that the professor at the community college or the four-year school where you're degree seeking owns college algebra, right? Which we know they don't. If the student learns college algebra, it can't be any better at one school over another.
But the sad part of that story is that the faculty believe they own it.
My wife, my brother, his wife, and my parents included. And that's not a knock on the faculty. That is a, they should teach the students that come to their institution, and they should teach them to the best of their ability, and they should teach their discipline. And if that's college algebra and gen ed curriculum, then that's great, but they also don't own that student.
Right.
Especially when more than 50% of what is being paid is actually our tax dollars, right?
We had a guest on last week who suggested as their best advice to college students is pick the best faculty member. The word's out on who's good and who's not. So if you have a course at a university and there's a rock star there, go take a course with that person.
Yeah.
In line with what Brad was thinking, let's say Brad is that savvy student who's approaching the buffet, selecting courses, and then ultimately graduating at the university of choice. You know, for me and for other current or former students, there's mentors or faculty, consistent people in their lives that made the difference between them from enrolling all the way till graduating. So is there a solution, and perhaps it's someone from Acadium or from the buffet offering here, whoever's hosting this buffet, that can provide a bit of stability or a consistent person in the student's life?
So I'm gonna reverse the question on you.
Okay.
And then I'll answer it. So in your academic career, do you remember all of your professor names, or do you remember your advisor names? Who would you say had the greatest impact in your success graduating?
For me, it was faculty, but I've been told by numerous people, including my spouse, that I'm not the norm. So maybe you shouldn't ask me.
Well, maybe if faculty were also your advisors.
They were. That's true.
If they took an interest in you beyond the classroom, then they would serve in that advising capacity. But what you find is that the support, the wraparound services, the advising capability is really the bridge at an institution. And Purdue did this great study that said that 70% of the students that ranked their school high did so for reasons beyond the classroom experience, right? And the people that they remember, the people that they would claim got them through to the degree were not in the classroom. And it might have been that same faculty member, but it was the faculty in an advising or another capacity. And so, I mean, I think, Brad, what you're getting at with your question is there still needs to be a guide on the side. There still needs to be somebody to engage that student. But I think we need to question whether that's the role of the faculty. And if it is, and the faculty are the advising capacity at an institution, then it needs to be written into the job description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most faculty don't see themselves as advising, even if it's part of their responsibility. And they need to know that their role as an advisor is actually more important in that student's success than the role as the faculty. And that's a huge mental shift for someone who is, you know, like my wife, who's earned her PhD to teach and to write a book. And it's like, write a book or publish, teach, and like so far down on that list is advising that she might not even have that on the job description.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a shift of the role of faculty and something that we need to all embrace. But, you know, we're not hiring faculty for advising skills versus research and writing skills. And that's where faculty can gain some strength back in the process.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for exploring that with us.
So give us your best prediction for the next 10 years in higher ed.
And he's prophetic. He already told us early on.
I think it's going to be an even more wild ride than it has been. And I think that companies are going to get into the space. I think that flattening of accreditation, we don't have regional and national accreditation anymore. We have institutional accreditation, which means a regionally accredited, a formally regionally accredited institution can now switch to another accreditation environment. So SACS to HLC, et cetera. And I think we're going to find that a Google University is going to come onto the scene and actually be able to award degrees. I think we're going to see a collapsing of the credential for a degree, and we're going to see companies get into the education space formally. And I think that's a good thing. Finally, I would say that we're going to continue to see the march towards non-traditional education, both online degrees and online students. I think we're going to get away from the word adult education because 16-year-olds are interested in online degrees and they're not adults. And that's a misnomer now, right? 75% of students on campus work, and many would work more if they had the flexibility to do so. So how is that student at 19 working two jobs to pay for their education different than the 29-year-old working to pay for it? Just the benefit is they have a more flexible schedule if they're in a quote unquote adult degree. I think we're going to continue to see campus closures where the school is either not the best in their region or the best in the country as a residential environment, because that population is going to continue to shrink. And if you can go to Harvard or in my backyard, Amherst College, and get a large scholarship, then yeah, it's worth it. And I'll send my kids to Amherst College if I get a large scholarship. Otherwise, there are quicker paths to earning the degree. And parents are going to start making that choice because of the economic realities that we're all facing.
I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who would label you as a heretic. And how dare you say that? But I think you're exactly right. And the motto of that is going to be only the strong will survive. So if schools can't adapt and change and grow, they're going to be left in the dust.
Yeah. And Brad, the easy answer to that is tell me any other industry that doesn't have the only strong will survive.
Absolutely.
Environment. And
yes, but we're higher ed, we're exempt.
Yeah. And in prior lifetimes, I think that was certainly the right answer. And with the increase in competition and decrease in traditional student population, you know, and I'm not the first to say this, this has been talked about for 10 years. There is this sort of seminal moment that we're facing, that we've been facing. And last year, seven of our colleges closed, seven of our members closed, and that's with our help. So, I mean, I've got a data set that is smaller than the entire country, but 3 years ago, we didn't have any close. So we know that these are realities and the numbers are only getting more and more dismal from an enrollment perspective.
Well, Nathan, you have given us lots to think about. Right. And the future is exciting, as you've described it. I think it's going to be fun to watch and be part of.
I've got my popcorn.
And by the way, you don't have any time to cook. When we asked you what you're most excited about, I just decided there's no time to cook.
Hey, he's not in the kitchen, but he's cooking.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good. So good.
Nathan, thanks. It's been so much fun to be with you.
Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks again, everybody.
And for all of our listeners, you can access additional resources associated with this podcast on our website, www.digitaltolearn.com. And it's numerical 2. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.